So we're on chapter 3 of Shantideva, about vowing. There's a little bit of handout here. Yes. I actually had sent it along with a bunch of other books to a friend. It just got swept up in the... She called me up and she said, "Did you mean for me to have this book?" Must be old age. Thank you. So Pema calls this transcending hesitation, which I like a lot. I think about a vow as kind of a grip and a knot in your stomach, maybe, or something. You know, gritting your teeth and saying, "I'm going to make this. I will. But vowing, this kind of vowing, isn't like that. This is about aiming the mind, you could say. Aiming your whole body and your whole mind in one direction. Or, as they usually say, commitment. To simply be 100% for what one is doing. In this case, 100% for everybody. 100% for all the beings in the world. So, this is, in terms of bodhicitta, this is when, after having gotten some idea about enlightenment or about one's own position and place and role in the world, to sort of wake up to the big question of what this is, and then a deep sense that there's something here. And perhaps now and then an experience of something here, or the biggerness of it. So this is the last stage of preparing the ground for practicing bodhicitta, to actually commit. And Shantideva goes through a great deal of it, a whole lot of rejoicing. And there's a formula, it's an ancient formula, and he follows it. You rejoice and you, in your mind, give away everything. Your whole body, everything you own, everything you've gained, and all attachments. You dedicate it all, you could say, to the welfare of the world. Of course, it isn't literal. You don't shed your clothes and your house and walk through the streets with nothing. But it's a state of mind of being willing at any moment to drop things for the benefit of whatever is happening at the moment. To continually try to benefit and create wholesome situations. It's like keeping the precepts. It isn't a perfect practice. It never gets perfect. But the intention is there. And that's what the vow is about. One intends and fails and tries again and goes on. So there's first the rejoicing and the giving of everything, and then there's determining to be whatever is needed. And Shantideva goes through a whole list of, he vows to be a boat, if a boat is needed, or a raft, a bridge, an island, a lamp, a bed, a slave, or food. It's a wonderful list. And it's true, we can't be the same thing in each situation. Sometimes something needs a bed. Sometimes somebody needs a lamp, a little light. So a great deal of our life, always anyway, is trying to intuit what's needed in each situation. How can I enact myself, my life, in this situation? What's needed now? What needs to be said? What needs to be not said? So it makes life very rich and interesting because it's different all the time. So then the vow comes, and you vow all of it, because our life is all and everything. And then he names that. It's butter, it's sun, it's a bridge, it's medicine. It can be anything. Anything can serve. So it's a very positive stance. It's being willing to be, let positive be the default position, even though sometimes we're full of doubt or very grumpy or find life very difficult. The vow is to maintain as much of a positive state of mind for the benefit of everything and everyone as we can. That's what bodhisattva practice is. So it's rejoicing in other people's good fortune and generating goodwill. Even, he says, toward our enemies, maybe especially toward our enemies. But it's important to include not just the sweet, easy, pleasant part, but even the dankest and darkest and most difficult part of it. It's all of a piece with us. So there's Pema talks about the three kinds of bodhisattvas, and I think they're kind of interesting. There's the royalty, the king or queen, who wake up first. They create a whole mind of enlightenment, you could say. They become as wide awake as possible in order to be able to meet with people. To put the kingdom in order first is how Pema puts it, and then be able to include all beings. I think these ways are maybe ways of describing different kinds of people. I mean, there are some very assertive people who just go for it, whatever it is. very direct. And some are like the ferryman who takes people across, riding with everyone. So the ferryman is the kind of person who's always reaching out and bringing other people in. You can see how some people, it's a typology in a way, a very simple typology. And then the last one is the shepherd, who is always coming up behind and putting everyone first. Oh, you go ahead. You go ahead. It's okay. And the shepherd coming up behind. And also, I think we take turns being these different modes, depending on what situation we're in, and what kind of mind we hold. So at the end, Shantideva talks about taking birth in Buddha's line. Having transcended hesitation, he's willing to take birth in, to be Buddha's child, you could say. It's an interesting metaphor. It takes us out of our personal practice and puts it in a much more universal place, which is indeed where it actually lies. He also talks about having found the precious gem. There's a story in the Lotus Sutra of a man who had a gem sewn into his cloak and went about in extreme poverty, not knowing that he had plenty. It's a wonderful metaphor for us in our sometimes poverty-stricken sense of ourselves. That we're not there yet, or we don't have something that we long for, and yet it's already here. We chant, but the Bodhisattva vows are not per se in here. What he says is, no, there isn't any real vow in here. Well, in every way, I will undertake activities benefiting such a rank, and I will do no act to mar or compromise this high and faultless lineage. Today I take my birth in Buddha's line and have become the Buddha's child and heir. So, it's not quite the one that we say, beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Koban said, beings are numberless, they will save themselves. Desires are inexhaustible, they will come to an end by themselves. Dharma gates are boundless, so there's always learning. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. Buddha's way is no above. So there is no attainment. I'm not sure attainment is the right word, but it's the meaning of that. There's nothing to get, no place to go. He more or less got that from Huineng, the sixth patriarch, who wrote a great deal about the four vows. And his take on this, on sentient beings and saving them, is the sentient beings of my mind. I vow to save the sentient beings of my mind. And the way to keep the vow, the bodhisattva vows, is just to keep setting the mind straight over and over again. He says, if you're full of evil thoughts, well, change it. Find something else to think about. You know, if you're making a lot of mistakes, stop for a while and see what you can do to do something else. It's actually, our practice is actually extremely simple. It's not some vast philosophical, in some sense. It's just about how to be, how to act our life, how to be our life, how to bring ourselves into completely 100% into our life. Or how our life wants to bring itself, into life itself. So vowing is really important. We do vows, you know, we do marriage vows, we do vows to be a doctor. A lot of professions include a vow. And then all of our ordinations in Buddhism are all about vowing. All about the bodhisattva vow, actually, and keeping the precepts. Very simple. So that's the very beginning. These first three chapters are kind of creating the situation, actually becoming aware of one's own situation, becoming grateful for it, beginning to see how huge the universe is and how beautiful the world is and how complicated and interesting it is, and how one's own life and self and body can be of active use in every moment, opened up to the world, opened up to the universe. And Shantideva being Shantideva, he's very romantic about it, very passionate about it. Take me, take all of me. So, are there questions?
Is the vow to save all sentient beings actually then a vow about ourselves, not to get in the way of others saving themselves?
Mm-hmm.
So it is, quote, up to us to let things be.
Yes.
So in some sense that explains the Chinese phrase, the action of no action. It's taking effort not to be actionable in the wrong way.
Yes.
In a way that interferes with nature, with a big N.
Yes.
Somebody recently, by the way, very interesting, talking about the roots of Zen in particular. And Somebody commented that, and this person happened to be Chinese, so they had a bias, but I thought I agreed with them, that they thought that Zen, Shan as it was in China, was very much an outgrowth of the Taoism that existed there previously, as opposed to a major influence from the Hinduism that came through the, you know, the background of the Buddha. So the nature, the notion of nature and things,
yes,
and the beauty of things in nature,
mm-hmm,
reflects on them, what we just commented on, that things have a way of themselves, and they are.
But Shantideva was Indian. So it's certainly this whole attitude about it is very Indian, very Buddhist, very Indian Buddhist. What happened with Taoism is that they didn't have words for the Dharma when the Dharma came to China. And so they took the words of Taoism and tried to, you know, squeeze it in, just the way we're trying to squeeze out words that, and they don't quite fit, like emptiness or shunyata. And there was a time when one emperor decided, because there were these three religions trying to vie for position in China. I've forgotten which era it was, but he decided to put them all together and have one religion that had Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism all as one thing. And that worked for a while, and I think they, though it broke up after, but I think they inseminated each other in many ways. So we've ended up with a lot of Taoism and Buddhism, which is nice. It's not the same, though. It's definitely not the same understanding. Yeah. Donna Lynn?
The term or sugatas? Is that more Tibetan, or is that?
It is Tibetan, okay. Yeah.
It's another name for Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something that we would use in Zen. Like,
no. No.
Okay.
No, that's Gyatso's coming from the Tibetan tradition. So all the terms that he uses are that way.
So many names for Buddhas.
Oh, I know. Yeah, lots and lots of them.
The concept now is ringing because I'm seeing all the connections to other things that we've explored. Mm-hmm. When Dogen talks about dropping mind, dropping body, one might infer from that what Dogen is saying, okay, let yourself and let everything be what it is. It's his way of saying this again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody wants to say, they asked a Zen teacher, I said, so what, you know, you've been giving Dharma talks for years and years, they're all the same thing, it's just each week is from a different angle. And
yes,
I feel that tonight more so than sometimes, mm-hmm, I see that.
Yeah.
It's very much the same.
It is. It's really hard to give talks night after night. You really start cramping the mind to squeeze something out of it. A new story.
So it's amazing we keep coming back and it all looks like we've never heard this story. All the same. I was like, wow.
Because it's an experience as well as an idea. And so what I try to do is encourage everyone to sit and cultivate the experience. and to cultivate it in life as well, walking around and talking. It's the same, to get out of the way of and let things in, let it all be as it wants to be. Kitty?
So when you say let beings save themselves, that doesn't mean do nothing.
No, it doesn't mean do nothing. No. No, it's not as easy as that.
But it means like show them if you can, that they can save themselves.
Yes. Yeah, whatever it takes. And there's no way to even say what it is, because it depends on the situation. Sometimes it's being right there in it, and sometimes it's being willing to step away from it entirely. Sometimes it's to do something that nobody would ever know you did that will help the situation along. It's trying not to be the star of the show and to help things as they go. So that's the hard part. You know, it's simple. The whole thing is very simple, but we're so tied up with ourself and our own self project that's what makes it difficult. As long as I'm the star, the center and the star, then it's that gets in the way. It's not a bad thing. It's just complicates things and creates a lot of unhappiness for ourselves and other people. So as the Dalai Lama is always saying, this is all about cultivating happiness for everyone. So it's not like it's a grim thing. It's just takes a lot of gumption to do. And it's kind of like pushing the door to get in without realizing that all you have to do is pull it in, pull it out.
I think that also ties in with something I just read, where the Dalai Lama is also, you know, about being the star. He says, well, I'm just a simple man.
Yes, always.
Same thing. Mother Teresa just said, you know, I'm just a simple servant.
Yeah. Yeah. Just doing the best they could. And they're all the forces, the causes and conditions that go into each life brought them into a place where they could do a great deal if they were humble enough and didn't run away with it. And that's why we remember them, because they did what they did without running away with it, without exalting themselves. They just kept going back to the problem and going back to trying to be with the problem.
They also had a whole kind of, I guess, culture behind them in a way. I mean, kind of brought them up. I mean, I think if Mother Teresa wasn't within the Catholic Church, for example, she probably would have been considered kind of crazy.
Well, she was considered crazy, and she created her own order, because nobody wanted her. She wouldn't fit into an order. She wanted to go out into the streets and just pull people out of the gutter, dying people out of the gutter, and nobody wanted to go along with that in the church. So she created her own order.
But like
the Dalai Lama
that she studied, you know,
she
had words that other people could relate to.
That's
true. I mean, it might have been rebellious in a way.
Yeah.
Like, it was, I mean, there was a common kind of ground there that she, I guess, could skillfully used to do what she needed to do.
Yeah, she was a teacher, basically, because she taught all of those concepts to people in India who had not been exposed to it. So in that sense, she created a world for herself and then functioned within it, as opposed to the Dalai Lama, who was born into it. Or, no, he was actually brought into it at the age of 5. He was born in a little village with 3 or 4 brothers and sisters, and they sought him out. They were looking for the next Dalai Lama, and they looked and looked and looked, and they brought all the things that he used to own, the teaching stick and the bell and things that the old Dalai Lama had before he died, and they took them and showed them to little kids and showed them other people's bells and teaching sticks and had them all mixed up together. And when they got to the Dalai Lama's house, he just went right straight to the one of the Dalai Lama before. Who knows? Who knows? I completely believe it when a Tibetan tells me that. Completely. And then when I think about it later, I think, that's really something. But we don't know.
They lucked out this time.
Huh?
They lucked out this time.
They did luck out this time. They got a good one. Wherever he came from, he really, he did become Avalokiteshvara, however that came about.
But isn't that the same with every group of people that are trying to seek something true, or, you know, you get some good ones and some...
Yes.
Ones
and some of the bad ones get good, mm-hmm. and some of the good ones go sour. So it's always changing. Yeah. We're lucky if we find somebody of real stature and autonomy who carries it all the way through as a gift to everyone. I'm sure our Dalai Lama is really tired by now. He's already announced he's going to retire. And he looks exhausted. And he's just kept going anyway. It's not easy. And Mother Teresa, I think, had a very hard life too. Very hard. But that's what this is being willing to have a hard life. Which is sort of against the American way, in a way, you know. We're always trying to have a life of ease. And he's saying, well, if you've got an easy life, why not go out there and challenge it? So, next week is chapter 4. Using our intelligence or awareness. And I'm pushing this book. It's a really good book.
Saturday sit. I was going to say, it's on the night. Okay. So it's a week from Saturday. I believe it's a half day.
Yes, I think it is.